I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Apollo 11 ushered in what many hoped would be a long era of space exploration that would lead humankind to the far reaches of the solar system and perhaps even beyond. 22 others followed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to the moon, but no person has walked on the lunar surface since 1972. Today on Midday, we mark the anniversary of Apollo 11's historic voyage with Robert Stone, the filmmaker whose documentary Chasing the Moon tells the story of the race into space, and Dr. John Logsdon, the founder of the Space Policy Institute. Plus, the gifted pianist Lafayette Gilchrist stops by to introduce his new CD, Dark Matter. First, the news. At precisely 4:17 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow, it will have been 50 years since a spidery-looking American spacecraft named Eagle touched down on the surface of the moon. 2 hours earlier, Apollo 11 mission commander Neil Armstrong and Lieutenant Buzz Aldrin had left Colonel Michael Collins alone in their command module as they began their trip to the moon and to their indelible place in history. Armstrong and Aldrin set the Eagle down on a lunar plain called the Sea of Tranquility in the nick of time. They had less than 30 seconds of fuel left by the time they touched down.
40 feet down, 2.5, picking up some dust. Fake shadow. Four forward, drifting to the right a little.
30 seconds.
Forward, just. Contact light. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent.
Auto
descent. Control both auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
6 hours later, Neil Armstrong emerged from the lunar module and slowly climbed down its metal ladder. With billions of people on Earth watching live on TV or listening on the radio, Armstrong became the first human to set foot on the lunar surface, uttering those famous words, "One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." 7 years earlier, in a speech at Rice University in Houston, Texas, President John F. Kennedy had made an aspirational proclamation.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
I'm Tom Hall. Today on Midday, the legacy of Apollo 11's historic mission to the moon and the future of space travel. My guests are Dr. John Logsdon, Professor Emeritus at George Washington University's Elliott School and the founder and longtime director of its Space Policy Institute. He's also a former member of the NASA Advisory Council and its Exploration Committee. Dr. Logsdon joins us on the line from his office in Washington. Welcome, sir.
Good afternoon.
And joining us on the line from the Hudson Valley in New York is filmmaker Robert Stone, the producer, writer, and director of an extraordinary new documentary called Chasing the Moon, which is currently streaming on PBS.org as part of its American Experience series. Mr. Stone, welcome to you as well, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Our phone number here at Midday, if you'd like to share your memories of the moon landing, if you're old enough to remember it, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Dr. Logsdon, let me ask you first, talk about the scene that Mr. Stone uses to open his terrific documentary, having to do with Sputnik and the Russian space program and the animating force that Sputnik ended up being to the U.S. space program.
Indeed, I think the Soviet Union defined the playing field by linking its space achievements, Sputnik and then Yuri Gagarin in 1961, as evidence of the superiority of the Soviet Union in the global competition, Cold War competition of the time. And by defining that as a measure of national power and national greatness, he put forward a challenge to President Kennedy, which Kennedy basically couldn't resist. He said, as you heard in the Rice speech, "Not we're going to enter this race and we're going to win it."
And Dr. Loxton, the United States reaction initially to the Sputnik program and to the Russian successes in space was that the Russians were going to use their space technology to weaponize they're going to weaponize things, and it was considered a military threat. This is in the middle of the Cold War.
Well, yeah, there was an element of that, but President Eisenhower was in office at the time, tried very hard to downgrade the propaganda significance of the Soviet space program as indicating anything in particular. His people called it just a basketball in space. That didn't work. The world reacted positively to Sputnik and even more positively to Gagarin in 1961.
And Robert Stone, your movie is just terrific. It's I recommend it highly. One of the people that you concentrate a lot on is the person that at the time was called Rocket Man. This is before President Trump began referring to the leader of North Korea as Rocket Man, Wernher von Braun. And he was one of many scientists who had been part of the Nazi regime who were brought to America to boost our program.
Yeah, I think von Braun is probably the central character to all 6 hours of the film. He's a sort of a through line to the whole thing. He's one of the most fascinating characters of the 20th century, I think. He was a man who was a colonel in Hitler's SS, built the first ballistic missile for Hitler's regime at the end of the war, comes to the United States, is brought to the United States by the U.S. Army to help develop the intercontinental ballistic missile here in the United States. In the early 1950s, he teams up with Walt Disney to sell the American public on this fantastic vision of bases on the moon and orbiting space stations, like, you know, we saw in 2001, the theme of which he started the show with, bases on the moon. He had this fantastic vision that we were going to go off to the stars with these rockets that he had developed. And he had a huge influence on American public opinion about whether this was going to be possible or not. And so when Kennedy was faced with this challenge that John has just pointed out, it was von Braun who said, "Well, look, we can't beat the Soviets immediately because their rockets are so much bigger than ours. But what we can do is move the goalposts." And moving the goalposts to something so audacious and visionary that it will require both countries to build an entirely new set of rockets, and, you know, basically set the an even playing field, and persuaded Kennedy that the Americans would have the edge because of our technological advancement and the fact that we had Wernher von Braun. And so Kennedy launched us to the moon based on von Braun's proposal. And he's the guy who developed the Saturn V. Is a really extraordinary character with a lot of complexity about his past with the Nazi regime. But I don't think we would have gotten to the moon without him.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your film, or you have a scene in the film in which you say that after the Second World War, America put about 2,000 undercover agents on the ground in Europe to find scientists. They were looking for people who had worked with the Nazi regime and perhaps elsewhere. But many of them were German scientists who had been part of Hitler's team that they persuaded to come to the United States. Von Braun says one of his proudest days was the day he became an American citizen. Was there ever any concern, you know, that these German scientists did not have the best interests of the U.S. space program at heart.
Well, you know, this was the height of the Cold War, and you know, the major geopolitical threat at that time was the Soviet Union, and no longer the defeated Nazi regime. So a lot of this stuff just got swept under the table, and their pasts were their past affiliation with the Nazi regime was successfully whitewashed and covered up and largely ignored by the American media. That began to change around the time of the first lunar landing, just because the times had changed. The media was much more skeptical and questioning about authority and the government at that time as a consequence of Vietnam and other things that were going on. But for most of the time that we were racing to the moon, the fact that former Nazis were leading the major space centers in the United States and at senior levels in the whole operation was largely, it was known but kind of ignored, and the details of it were covered up pretty successfully.
Yeah, and John Logsdon, we should mention that you are featured prominently in Mr. Stone's movie along with many other experts.
My voice was featured.
Your voice was featured, right?
And Robert didn't use any images of talking heads, just our voices.
Just your voices. They are voices of paradigmatic erudition. It's terrific. And one of the pivotal moments in the space program was a decision that von Braun actually ultimately disagreed with. His approach to getting to the moon concerned an Earth orbit, and the approach that NASA eventually decided was a lunar orbit approach to getting to the moon. What are the differences between the two ways of getting to the lunar surface?
Sure. Ultimately, by the way, von Braun agreed with the approach chosen, and his agreement was crucial to moving forward. Earth orbit rendezvous meant launching the separate parts of the lunar landing spacecraft on a series of rockets, two or three, and assembling them, rendezvousing in Earth orbit. And once you have the ship assembled, heading off to the moon. The problem with that approach is it meant landing on the moon with the weight of the fuel required to come back and the heat shield for reentry, things that you didn't need until you were off to the moon after the landing and coming back. The lunar orbit rendezvous approach avoided all that. It sent a mothership into lunar orbit with the heat shield and fuel for the return journey, and then had a specialized spidery little spacecraft that we're now all familiar with, the lunar module, which only went from lunar orbit down to the surface and back up. The thing that blew everybody's mind is that that would require the two ships to rendezvous in lunar orbit after the successful landing, and we had never done a rendezvous. So basing the whole program on something that we had never done, and we were 250,000 miles away from home, was very nerve-wracking for a number of people, including President Kennedy's science advisor.
Yeah, and Mr. Stone, it was a very nerve-wracking endeavor from the moment it separated from the command module. It's interesting to realize that the a guy named Robert Lanius wrote a book about this for Smithsonian, and he observes that the Eagle, the thing that separated from the command module and landed on the surface of the moon, had the tensile strength of aluminum foil. With these gangly legs that spread out and made it look like a spider. This is like driving an early edition of the Toyota Prius, for gosh sakes. I mean, this is amazing. And then as they get to the surface, they almost run out of gas. How did that, what was plan B if they in fact had run out of fuel?
Well, I add to that that the onboard computer had about as much computing power as a electronic greeting card you'd pick up at the supermarket. So, you know, it was pretty amazing. No, I think, you know, this was an extremely daring and risky undertaking, and it's very easy in hindsight to overlook just how how daring and risky it was, because everything went so well. I mean, yes, we had Apollo 13, but we got everybody back alive. We've never lost anyone in space. Armstrong landed on the moon with about 17 seconds of fuel left in the tanks. They were coming down, the landing site that they had selected was full of boulders. There was a 100-yard wide crater right there, and he had to use up extra fuel to find a safe place to land. And, you know, this is a spaceship that nobody's really ever flown before in that kind of situation, you know, trying to land on the moon. They had these simulators that they had used on Earth to try to simulate it, and Armstrong famously had nearly been killed in one. It crashed a couple of times. So it was touch and go. And the whole world was watching this and listening in, and we were all on pins and needles.
Yeah.
All week and kind of hanging out with some of the people, including the Capcom, Charlie Duke, whose voice you heard saying, we're about to turn blue. He Duke, was about to call an abort, but then heard that they were within 30 feet of the surface, and he said, I could call an abort, but Armstrong's going to land it.
Yeah. Now, if he had called an abort, what was their option? Did they have enough fuel to get back to the command module?
That was a totally separate engine in the ascent part of the lunar module that was what was used to get them off the surface of the moon. So that could have been fired at any point and basically kicked them back into a rendezvous orbit.
Yeah, talk about messing up your TV ratings if you end up not landing the thing on the surface. Dr. John Logsdon is a professor emeritus at George Washington University and the founder of its Space Policy Institute. Robert Stone is the writer, producer, and director of Chasing the Moon, a new six-hour documentary on America's lunar mission that you can find on demand on PBS. We'll have more on the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing right after a quick break. You are welcome to join our conversation. We'll take a couple calls when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, my guest is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. Yesterday, the commissioner released his plan to address the crime problem in Baltimore. He'll spend the hour with us Monday talking about what's in it and what's different about what's been tried before. So Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison joins me here on Midday Monday at noon. If you're just joining us today, we, along with a whole bunch of other of our friends here at NPR, are remembering the historic Apollo 11 lunar mission that landed the first humans on the moon 50 years ago tomorrow. We're joined today by two distinguished chroniclers of that milestone in human history. Dr. John Logsdon is the founder and longtime director of George Washington University's Space Policy Institute and the author of three books about the Apollo program. Filmmaker Robert Stone is the writer, director, and producer of Chasing the Moon, a documentary available on PBS.org about the U.S. space program. You are welcome to be part of our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So Dr. Logsdon and Mr. Stone, let's go to the phones to Amelia in Baltimore. Amelia, welcome to Midday. How you doing?
I'm okay. Thank you.
So where were you when the Eagle landed?
I was in Korea, bumping along the not-so-hot roads on a bus with a bunch of GIs working for the Red Cross. And we were listening to it on the military available, whatever it is. I don't remember the call letters. But what is especially fun about it is that because of the time change, it happened on my birthday, which is the 21st of July.
Well, happy birthday. That's great. That's great. And Robert Stone, everybody who was alive at the time, I was 14 at the time, I remember watching it with my family from a little cabin on Sebago Lake in Maine, where we were vacationing for a few days. We lived in Massachusetts at the time. It's one of those places like, where were you when President Kennedy was shot? Where were you when 9/11 occurred? People remember where they were. But it's interesting that prior to the success of Apollo 11, public support for the space program was by no means overwhelming.
That's very true. First, I just want to tell your audience the movie will be broadcast on PBS tomorrow, all 6 hours of it, so you can binge it on the anniversary.
Oh, great. But, you can binge it or you could stream it. Yeah, great.
Yeah, and you can stream it. It's available everywhere. But you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that we brought to light in the movie is that the effort, the political and public relations effort to maintain support for this project over the better part of a decade and through multiple administrations was almost as challenging as the technological feat of actually putting a man on the moon. There was not a great public outcry to do this from the get-go. If the polling suggests that there was only two times during the 1960s when a plurality of Americans thought that it was worth the cost, and that was briefly during Apollo 8, which took place over Christmas in 1968, the first orbit around the moon, and then again during Apollo 11. But for the rest of the time, people thought, it's nice, I'm glad we're doing this, but it's probably not really worth the cost, which makes the political effort that to get this done, all the more impressive, really.
Unfortunately, I think the thing that sealed that we would do Apollo was President Kennedy's assassination, because Apollo became a memorial to a fallen young president. And the idea of canceling it, even during the aftermath of the Apollo 1 fire, just was not a politically viable option. So if Kennedy had lived, would we have met the deadline is an interesting counterfactual question.
Yeah, and it was happening, of course, at a time in American history that was incredibly turbulent. President Kennedy had been shot. Martin Luther King had been killed. Robert Kennedy had been killed. It was a very the Vietnam War was raging. As a matter of fact, Ralph Abernathy, who succeeded Dr. King as the director of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, led a protest at the launch site. Here's part of what he said in that situation.
We may go on from this day to Mars and to Jupiter and even to the heavens beyond. But as long as racism, poverty, hunger, and war prevail on the earth, we as a civilized nation have failed.
And Robert Stone, you also have a good deal of footage of Frank Borman, who was the commander of Apollo 8, the first spacecraft to circle the moon, to do an orbit, a lunar orbit. He served as an ambassador for NASA in the 60s and 70s, and he says that his receptions outside of the United States were always more positive than the ones he had in the United States, particularly on college campuses among young people.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting story we talk about in the film that's, somewhat forgotten, is that in the late 60s, the astronauts were associated in the minds of many people in the counterculture and college students with the military-industrial complex and Vietnam and President Nixon, who they opposed. And so there was not just a lack of support among certain sectors of the population, particularly, the counterculture at that time. There was actually outright opposition. And that manifested itself sometimes with protests against astronauts when they appeared on college campuses and things like that. That said, I think it's important to remember that I think the sense of optimism and a belief in the future, a belief that we can overcome any problem, social, political, technological, Apollo symbolized, that sense of optimism spilled over even among people who opposed the space program and thought it was a waste of money. And I think that's one of the defining features of that era that we look back on, is this sense of optimism about the future and the sense that problems could be solved. I mean, you wouldn't be a civil rights activist or an environmental activist or a women's activist if you didn't think that there was a brighter future ahead. And Apollo symbolized that in a very great and symbolic way that even Ralph Abernathy acknowledged during his protest at the Kennedy Space Center on the eve of Apollo 11.
Robert Stone is the filmmaker behind a terrific documentary called Chasing the Moon that is streaming tomorrow, or is streaming all the time on PBS.org, and is also going to be shown in its entirety. It's 6 hours long tomorrow on PBS. Dr. John Logsdon is the founder and longtime director of George Washington University's Space Policy Institute. He's also written 3 books about the Apollo program. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones to Sylvia in Baltimore. Sylvia, where were you when the Eagle landed?
Well, 50 years ago today, I was, and yesterday and tomorrow also, I was in the Soviet Union. I watched Neil land on the moon in Moscow in a tiny little black and white TV high up on a tiny pedestal so that several people could see it at once. And I'm trying to think how many people could have been there at the time that I saw it. I don't think there were more than maybe 25 or 30 people in the room. And it's possible because it was in a hotel that there were other people from other parts of the world, but I don't think there were other Americans there. And I think there were Russians, and everyone was so thrilled. But to me, the most exciting thing for me, or to remember about it, was that the night before, I had gone to a cafe in Moscow with a Russian friend. And I don't quite know how, but suddenly the word spread throughout the cafe that there was an American at our table. And the young people in the cafe all crowded around my table and started pumping me with questions. You know, where are they now? What's happening now? Tell us what's going on. And I didn't know anything. It was as if they thought I had a direct line to the astronauts. And I was hoping they would tell me, because I was having difficulty reading the news in the newspapers or seeing it on television or understanding anything.
Yeah, well, that's a great story, Sylvia, and it must have been amazing being in the Soviet Union watching this great American triumph. Professor Logsdon, it's interesting that after this initial landing on the moon, there were many others. Some 22 other people did what Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong did. The last one was...
No, only 10 more.
Oh, 10 more. I'm sorry. I got the number wrong.
5 landings after 11.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for that correction. But there was much less attention paid to the subsequent landings after Apollo 11. Why do you think that there's international attention to Apollo 11 that dwindled considerably subsequently?
Well, I mean, when you define something as a race with a finish line, and the finish line in this case was land on the moon and return safely to Earth before the decade is out, once you do that, it's kind of over. And unfortunately, the public has a relatively short attention span and moves on to something else. The subsequent missions were equally challenging and scientifically more productive, but they didn't have the human drama of 11. And the media lost its interest rather quickly. By Apollo 13, there was no real-time constant coverage of the mission. So there was a judgment that the American public had indeed lost its interest.
And Mr. Stone, it was an international drama, but there was also all sorts of interpersonal drama. You talk a lot about in the movie how they decided which of the two astronauts, Aldrin or Armstrong, would be the first to actually set foot on the surface of the moon. Tell us a little bit about how that came down.
Yeah, it's funny because, in retrospect, you just assumed, well, of course, Armstrong was going to be first. But that was not at all clear when the mission was when they were first sort of introduced as the first people who would go to the moon. In fact, we've got a great scene in the movie where the first press conference where they're asked this very question, and Armstrong says, well, it hasn't been decided who's going to be first. And Aldrin starts discussing the details of what the first man would do when he set foot on the earth, on the moon. And even though we didn't know who that person was, and you can see Armstrong glowering at him. the competition between the two over this was clear as day.
Collins
in that scene
describes the crew as amiable strangers.
Yeah,
they worked well together to do their job, but they didn't socialize together. And Buzz was pressured by his father to be first, and carry that with him.
He actually did some lobbying about that to NASA. I mean, who made the ultimate call? Was it Armstrong's call to make, or was it somebody above him at NASA?
Well, I mean, Armstrong was the commander and exercised the commander's prerogative, but I think that was certainly with the concurrence of the chain of command from the astronaut's boss, Deke Slayton, up the lines. They recognized at the time the very different personalities of those two individuals and said, if one is going to be first man, it should be Neil. He's the ideal person to do that. I was with Buzz as recently as last night, and I still don't think he's gotten over it.
Yeah. So this is not a small matter to be sure. Yeah. Of course, I want to ask you, both of you can weigh in on this, about Mr. Armstrong's first utterances when he stepped on the moon. There are those who said he just sort of blew his line and said he should have said one step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. There are others who say he did say one small step for a man, but because the audio was so froggy, we didn't hear it. Robert Stone, where do you come down on that argument?
I think it hardly matters. I cannot imagine a better thing to say. And the fact that, you know, it's such a memorable line. It's one of the most memorable lines of the 20th century. Better words could not have been spoken. And coming from a man who was not known for his eloquence, it's all the more extraordinary. I think it doesn't matter at all.
I agree. And Dr. Logsdon, did he prepare those remarks himself, do you think, or were there people who helped him?
They were very much his words, and it was made very clear that nobody was going to suggest to him what to say. Neil, in his later years, said, I may have said it, but I certainly intended to say it, the A. And again, I was just down at the Kennedy Space Center, and there's a display of the lunar module, brand-new display, with the words on the display, and they put the A in parentheses. So it's still not formally decided.
Neil Armstrong gave a press conference during the Apollo 11 crew's sort of post-flight world tour. He was in Latin America when he talked about, in retrospect, that experience of being on the moon.
I felt very small and very lucky. And as we looked up from the surface of the moon, we could see above us up here the planet Earth. And it was very small, but it was very beautiful. And it looked like an oasis in the heavens. And we thought it was very important at that point for us and men everywhere to save that planet as a beautiful oasis that we together can enjoy for all the future.
And Robert Stone, the environmental movement really came into its own just a few years after that, two or three years after that moon landing. The Apollo program, the space program in general, launched so many scientific discoveries and so many areas of interest for scientists in the United States and around the world. This was not just about space exploration, was it?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, that's how it began. But Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist, said that it was not a great fan of the space program, but said that the entire project was worthwhile if the only thing that came out of it was the photograph of the Earth from the surface of the moon, or from orbiting the moon, the famous photo Earthrise picture that Bill Anders took on Apollo 8. There was a sense at that time that image of the Earth from space had such a profound impact on our sense of self, our sense of place, our sense of brotherhood and community living on, you know, what was called spaceship Earth, that it would have ripple effects throughout society. And I think, you know, not everything, we didn't break out, and world peace didn't break out all over the world, and we've all lived in harmony ever since. But it did spawn or did inspire the environmental movement, which the first Earth Day took place less than a year after the landing on the first landing on the moon. And, you know, the technological revolution that we're enjoying the aftermath of right now is really directly tied to the technological advancements that were made to put a man on the moon. Miniaturization of electronic components and things like this, advances in microchips. You know, we're the beneficiaries of that every day, including the iPhone that I'm speaking to you now.
Yeah. We are almost out of time. Let me go to Steve in Northwest Baltimore on the phone for a very quick comment. Steve, where were you when?
Yeah, I was out of the country too, like the other two people that talked to you earlier. And I was with people in Israel, and we all watched the TV together. And when we hit down and everything was safe, they said, "Congratulations, you did a great job." I said, "I had nothing to do with it." "Oh, yes, you did. You did. Everybody did there in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, you guys did it." And this is what happened all over the country and all over the world, that were watching this at the same time we were here in Baltimore.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that comment, Steve. I appreciate it. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are running out of time. I want to give Professor Logsdon the last word. The fact that public support for or against the space program in a way is kind of irrelevant now, given that space travel has now been sort of taken over in the private sector. What are your feelings about the chances for the kind of leaps and bounds of scientific discovery happening if it's Amazon or Elon Musk or whomever going to the moon instead of NASA?
Well, Tom, I don't want to end by correcting you, but the private sector has not launched a person yet. The only person, U.S. entity that launches people into space is NASA.
Yep, and that's a good point.
There's a lot of image of the future of SpaceX and Blue Origin taking over a lead role, but it hasn't happened yet. We still need NASA. I think the celebration of this 50th anniversary and all the attentions being paid to it really reminds us that this was something that the country did once that was great, and it was something that's lasted in our memory, and I think we want to do it again.
Dr. John Logsdon is a professor emeritus at George Washington University's Elliott School and founder of its Space Policy Institute. Robert Stone is an Oscar and Emmy-nominated filmmaker. His documentary about the Apollo 11 lunar mission and the space program is called Chasing the Moon. It's terrific. You can stream it at pbs.org. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I very much appreciate it.
Happy to be with you.
Thanks so much.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Quick break, then a great jazz pianist joins me here in Studio A, Lafayette Gilchrist. We'll talk about his new CD, Dark Matter. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.